Hi everyone, this is Tim. Welcome to North and South Podcasts. And I've got a fantastic person coming on this week to talk about his life story, and that is Kev Donnelly. He was someone I've heard about through the grapevine for years. He's got a blog, he's been in the media before, he's been on TV programmes before. So, Kev, we're going to talk today about thalidomide. Now, my generation, I remember growing up and seeing like John Pilger's World in Action and stuff about thalidomide. We'll come to that a little bit later. But first of all, do you want to just introduce yourself? Who are you and what's your kind of background, as it were?
Okay, hi, Tim. Well, you've said a lot of it already. I am a thalidomider, which means I'm physically disabled. And my disability was caused by a drug which was manufactured in Germany in the late 1950s. It was a massive scandal and a massive cover-up. And I was born in November 1961, which was actually the week that the drug was withdrawn from the UK market, even though, you know, it had been around for almost, you know, 6 years before. It wasn't withdrawn until November 1961, and that was the week I was born. As you say, there was about 400-odd thalidomiders born in the UK. We don't know the real figure, though, because a lot of babies were just left to die in hospital. It was like an unofficial euthanasia. And people are shocked when I tell them that, but it's true. So we don't know the true figure. And thank God my mother took me home from hospital. When I was born, my mother wasn't allowed to see me for a few days. I mean, the doctors were surprised as anyone when I was born, because in those days, there was no like ultrasound scans or anything like that. So when I popped out, you know, they were shocked too. And my mother was, you know, eventually told what was wrong with me. And then the nurse said, you may as well leave him here because he's not going to live that long. And the doctors predicted I'd live for about 6 weeks. And thank God my mum said, no, I'm taking him home. Because otherwise I would have been one of those unknown statistics, you know, maybe one of the thousands that died, you know, within the first few days.
Just for people who might not be aware, a thalidomide baby will be born and they'll have very short limbs, won't they? See, they're easily recognisable at the moment of birth.
Yeah.
Now, a lot will not be born and they may be stillborn or there may be problems with the pregnancy. But as you said, there was about 400 who survived, as it were, and we don't know the true nature of the numbers involved, do we? Sorry, please continue.
Okay. I was just going to say that there's a BBC programme called Call the Midwife. And it's like, it's not my kind of drama. It's too whimsical and nostalgic for me. But they did a really, really good couple of programmes on thalidomide. And it was very brave of them. They actually showed a scene of a baby who was just like me, abandoned in the hospital. And the midwife put the baby on the windowsill of the sluice room. It was in the middle of winter. And they left the window open. And the baby died of hypothermia. And the BBC actually showed that in the drama. They must have consulted lawyers and everything, but it was a lot. They went ahead with it because that's what happened. You know, many babies were deliberately starved to death, you know, nailed by mouth jobs and things like that. So it was like an unofficial euthanasia. So thank God my mother, and sometimes when I talk about my mother, I'm quite critical of her, you know, the way she was really overprotective. But in many ways, I'm very, very grateful. She kind of like, you know, raised me up and saved me life. And that sounds dramatic, but it's true. I could have easily been abandoned. Thalidomide, there's not one thalidomide that's exactly the same. We're all kind of unique and we're all different shapes and sizes. And it affected us in many, many ways. I'm what's called a four limber, which means I was affected in all four limbs. And for listeners, I'll just describe my disability. Basically, I was born without arms and legs in a nutshell. On my shoulders, I've got like small arms with 3.5 fingers on my right hand and 2 fingers on my left. And on my hips, I've got 2 perfectly formed feet, you know, the same amount of toes on each foot, you know, with a big toe, 4 little toes, a heel and an arch. But the feet sort of like stick up. And they're attached to my hips, so I don't actually walk on them. For most of my life, I actually got around on the floor, you know, shuffling around on my bottom. And even when I lived independently, I lived like that for quite a while. So everything in my flat was adapted for my needs. So all the light switches are like 2 foot off the ground. I had low shelves in the kitchen, you know, mini fridge, mini freezer, microwave. The sink was at my height. So when I had a personal assistant, she would have to be on her knees to reach my sink, but it was all adapted to my level. And I had like wooden steps going up to the loo and steps going up to my bed because I could climb steps when I was younger. In the last house I lived with my mum, she had a big 6-bedroom house in Crosby and my bedroom was on the first floor. So I was like super fit in those days. I'm not sure I could climb stairs now though. I'll be 63 in November. So the doctor's got it totally wrong in terms of like it's only last 6 weeks. There's just over 400 surviving thalidomides in Britain now, as of about 460. So quite a few of us have died for various reasons. And sometimes for just natural reasons, nothing to do with thalidomide. As I was saying, we're all different shapes and sizes. The most common form of thalidomide is where they've just been affected in the arms, where they've got short arms, and the majority have legs. Yeah. So the four limbers like me, there's only about 40 in Britain that would affect both arms and legs. Some were born without legs, but perfectly formed arms. One of my best mates in school was Johnny, and he got around like a monkey. He'd literally walk around on his arms, and he was dead strong, you know, because he used his arms for everything, and he could lift his own whole body weight, and he could like push himself in a wheelchair and everything. But the most common form, as I say, is the ones with short arms. There are also people who've been born blind and deaf. I was born deaf in my right ear. I've always been deaf in my right ear. But as I've got older, my other ear is sort of packing in now, so I wear two hearing aids. The worst case that I know of in Britain, a boy who was born without no hands at all, just shoulders. At least I'm fortunate enough to have hands and no legs. And he was born blind and deaf. And basically, he lived his life in a cot in hospital. And he just screamed all day. I mean, it was tragic. So I'm infinitely better off than him. But he's born, can you imagine that? Blind, deaf, and no limbs at all. Another good friend of mine, Jeanette, who sadly passed away 10 years ago, she was born without any hands at all. She had no legs and just shoulders. But she was a remarkable woman. She was really a strong woman. She could defend herself verbally. She was amazing. She used to love embarrassing, like, you know, people in authority and politicians. And she became a mom, and she was remarkable. But as I say, sadly, she died about 10 years ago. So that's my disability anyway, in a nutshell.
Sorry, I was just going to ask, are there any other key, there's a few other things that can happen, isn't there, with thalidomide that you might not always see? But sometimes there's a lot of miscarriages and stillbirths because the body struggles to survive. So there's lots of other things as well, isn't it, that go with it?
There's a lot of like hidden things that even now I'm finding more and more things about my body. For example, when I was about 20, I had severe pain in my left hand side and I was in agony. And an emergency doctor came out and said, I think you've got appendicitis. So he phoned an ambulance. And within an hour, I had the operation. And then when I came around from the operation, he said, I'm afraid you were born without an appendix. What you had was an internal infection, and it could have been treated with antibiotics. So when he cut me open, I didn't even have an appendix. I've had a lot of issues with kidney stones throughout my life. And the very first operation I had, you know, to get them removed, it took them hours just to find my kidneys because apparently my organs are all twisted inside. So even internally, I'm kind of like damaged, if you like. A lot of thalidomides as well were born infertile. They're not able to have children. A lot are, though. I mean, there's tons of thalidomides who've got kids. And a lot of them are grandparents now as well. And it's not genetic. It can't be passed on from one generation to another. And I remember watching a documentary. I should say throughout my life, because we're kind of unique, if you like, the media have been very interested in us. So I've been thrown in the media from day one, really. I was always, you know, the newspapers were like following me around school and everything I did in my life, the newspapers would be knocking on my door. If I passed my driving test, you know, being the Liverpool Echo. And it wasn't me contacting the press. They contact me, do you know what I mean? Initially, my mother did. She used the press to get compensation. We needed the media. because the government were like resistant. You know, the drug company were denying everything, and the government was resistant, saying it wasn't, it's not our fault. Enoch Powell was the minister at the time, you know, that old fascist. And he refused to have a public inquiry.
Well, when you mention his name, I'm not surprised. With his track record, there was no public inquiry.
But the drug company was Chemie Grünenthal, which is a German company. And they employed a lot of doctors from the Nazi era. And one of the doctors, two of the doctors actually worked in the SS concentration camps. And then the Americans got them out of prison because the Americans got a lot of the Nazis off, you know, the scientists, etc. But Chemie Grünenthal employed two prominent Nazi doctors, and they did experiments in the Nazi concentration camps. And one of them invented nerve gas. That was his speciality. And he was the one who, you know, I'm not saying like he deliberately invented thalidomide to cause damage, but we're dealing with criminals from the beginning, do you know what I mean? There's a massive cover-up.
No, I think that's a good encapsulation of what thalidomide is.
I've just remembered. And because our parents were battling against, you know, the government, against the drug company, and we were trying to get compensation, my mother was one of 62 parents that decided to sue. Now, they were just like working-class parents. They knew nothing about, you know, class action or, you know, big major lawsuits. And they hired a company called Kimber Bull, who went bust shortly after the action because they'd never taken on such a big case either. But we were up against the establishment. We were up against a big, massive company. The people who had the license to distribute the drug in Britain was distillers. And they were taken over by Guinness. So you can imagine, you know, we're taking on a big, massive company. And my mother did all the fighting. She was fighting the lawyers and the doctors and the politicians, her and other parents. And I was blissfully unaware of this because I was just a young kid. So she realised, you know, using the media was one of the tools in the armoury, if you like, to get compensation. And that's why the media was very much interested in us. I was in the days before Murdoch took over the Times, and the Sunday Times was really instrumental in fighting our case. So that's why I've been in the media a lot of my life. It wasn't settled until I was about 12, and even then I wasn't allowed to take the money until I was 21, and it was left in the law courts. And I was awarded the princely sum of £22,000, which in the late 1970s is quite a lot of money. But it's still a pittance when you think about arms and legs. I mean, it's hard to put a value on arms and legs. But, you know, pop stars can sue for slander and get paid millions, you know, if someone's told a lie about them. Do you know what I mean? So the whole system is wrong, really. But anyway, when it came out the courts, I remember actually when I was about 14, I remember my mother saying, when you're older, you're going to vote Tory. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you're going to be rich. And I thought, what a load of rubbish. The effect it had on me was that, oh, well, Tories only care about rich people then. You know, I've never been a Tory, I never will. But my mother assumed that the 22,000 would double, you know. If it's in the law courts, they would have invested it in stocks and shares, and it would have doubled by the time I was 21. But I was one of a handful of thalidomiders who actually got a lesser amount. When it came out the courts, it was just over £19,000. If they'd have put it in a building society over the late 70s, early 80s, you know, the interest alone, it probably would have almost doubled. But I actually lost money on it, and there was nothing I could do about it. And I remember Lord Denning, who was the master of the rolls, who was in charge of the money, had the cheek to say, do you want to keep it in the courts? So I said, no. So I took it out immediately. I even lost out then, and that only happened to a handful of thalidomiders. Oh, yeah, the 62 parents were like, really brave taking on, you know, these companies. And we had really bad advice from this rubbish legal firm. But it was also a divide and rule thing. What the drug company said and what the government said was, you have to settle. So it was, they never admitted liability or damages in court. We had to settle as a court. And what they said was, if you don't settle, none of the other parents will get a penny. So the other parents who didn't bother suing, for whatever reason, I don't blame them. they were told if this these 62 didn't settle as a cause, none of you'll get a penny. So you can imagine what happened then. My mother was getting loads of abusive letters, you know, from other parents and phone calls, and they were fighting amongst each other. It was the old divide and rule trick because they knew that's what would happen. So the 62 were forced to settle. So then afterwards, there was a guy called Mr. Mason. I can't remember his first name. Well, there was a Thalidomide girl called Louise, and she was a disability was almost identical to mine. Feet attached to her hips and short arms. Her dad was called David Mason, and he was like a really successful art dealer, fabulously rich. And he was on the Antiques Roadshow occasionally, you know, as an art expert. And you would think he would provide the best care in the world for his daughter, but he actually dumped her in a home and institution. And that's another reason I'm grateful for my mother. The ones that survived, a lot of them were dumped in institutions, and she had a hell of a time. And she wrote a biography about it, and she was abused in the institution and everything. And she had a really hell of a time. She wouldn't speak to her father for years. They made it up just before he died, but sadly, Louise is dead now as well. And she ended up getting married and having kids. And she was a remarkable woman, but she sadly passed away. But as I say, her dad dumped her in Shirley Heritage, which was an infamous home for disabled kids, which is now thankfully closed. But because he was powerful and he had contacts in the establishment, if you like, he took on the court case for the rest of the parents. And he also got the Sunday Times on board, and he got other influential people. And the ones who weren't in the initial 62, but the ones who sued afterwards under David Mason, they got a much bigger payout. So I lost out again. If my mother had just sat back and not bothered, I would have been better off. But I'm still grateful for her that she took on, you know, the establishment and the companies. But anyway, but sadly, Louise Mason died, but she wrote a biography, and it's actually amazing. I can't remember what it's called, but it's brilliant.
It's a terrible thing, isn't it? I mean, we're going to talk about the way disabled people were treated in the 60s, 70s and the 80s, because I remember my uncle was in an institution. I remember going to visit him in the 80s. And we can talk about the social model of disability, which is... It's something that's a bit more out there now. But just going back 1 second, just to sum up where you are now, because I've got lots of skills and experience. You're a lecturer. You've been a disability rights campaigner. Yeah. And as well as having a lived experience of disability, you've been involved in a lot of campaigns against prejudice and discrimination. You've had children. Yeah. And you're very much leading what might be considered a normal life. And... that's come through a lot of determination and because of all those battles that people fought in the past. And I think that one of the shocking things for me is I remember going to visit my uncle at an institution in the 80s. Mm. And it's a different universe now. It's still not perfect, far from it. But it's a different universe than what it used to be. And that what you said about your friend Louise and the way things were in the past, so many people were just written off. And it's a really, really tragic thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the sad thing with Louise, her dad was a multimillionaire. Mm. He had like a big mansion in Chelsea. I think he lived opposite, you know, Marino, the Chelsea football manager. Mm. You know, that's how rich he was. In fact, his next door neighbour was Cliff Richards. So, you know, we're talking mega rich. So he could have provided the best care for her. But he even admitted, or she admitted in a documentary, you know, the daughter, that the parents wanted the perfect child, and he has other children. And because Louise wasn't, quote, perfect in their eyes, she was dumped in this nursing home. But yet he got loads of credit, you know, for taking on the cause and fighting distillers and fighting, you know, the German drug company. But he got a lot of kudos for that. But it was Louise who came out and said, well, actually, you know, he abandoned me in a nursing home. So it was quite remarkable. But the other thing I was saying about, you know, a lot of thalidomides were infertile. I remember watching a documentary, World in Action, the first World in Action they made about me when I was about 10. The interviewer said to me, mother, Kevin's infertile, isn't he? And my mother said, oh, yes, he's damaged down below, right? And she said, he'll never be able to be a father. So I'm watching this, you know, mother never ever discussed it. She was very, very old-fashioned. We never discussed sex or anything like that. When I was 10, I wasn't actually bothered. I wasn't interested in the opposite sex. I was just interested in playing with my mates and stuff like that. It wasn't like a big deal. It was only when I was a teenager and my hormones were like bouncing off the walls, I started to think about the opposite sex. I didn't get a proper girlfriend until I left home, really, when I was 22. She wasn't disabled. I mean, that's the other thing. When I say I'm married, and a lot of people say, "What's wrong with your wife if she's disabled?" And that's really annoying. But anyway, my girlfriend wasn't disabled. And the reason was because when I was younger, I didn't really mix with other disabled people. It wasn't an issue. I just knocked around with, regular people, if you like. And disability wasn't at the forefront of my mind. Anyway, this girl was amazing and she wasn't bothered about my disability. In fact, we met on a telephone chat line. It was the days before the internet.
I
It was
remember
called
them
Talk.
chat lines.
Yeah. And it cost a fortune, but I used to work for social services at the time. I ran up Sefton Council's phone bill massively. In between clients, I'd be on the phone on these chat lines. But I remember talking to a girl. She managed to get my home phone number. And we were chatting for like weeks and weeks and weeks. And she said, "You sound dead nice. I want to meet you." And she said, "How tall are you?" Because I never mentioned anything about thalidomide to her. I said, "Oh, I'm about 6 foot 2 or something like that." I just made it up. She said, "Oh, you sound dead nice. I want to see you." But I kept putting her off. And I said, "Oh, no, I'm busy, blah, blah, blah." And then eventually she got like really frustrated. She said, "You're not telling me the truth." She said, "Are you married?" I said, "No, I'm not married." She said, "Are you engaged?" I said, "No, I'm not engaged." She said, "Are you gay?" I said, "No, I'm not gay." She said, "What's the problem then? Why can't I see you?" I said, "Well, all right then." I said, "I'm not exactly 6 foot 2." And she said, "How tall are you?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I've not really measured myself." I said, "Probably about 2 foot." And then she said, "Are you a dwarf?" I said, "No, I'm not a dwarf." I said, "Have you ever heard of the term thalidomide?" And she said, "I have actually. There's a girl who went to my school who's got no arms." I said, "Well, that's me. I've got no arms either." I said, "But also, I've got no legs." And then I expected the phone to go click and never hear from her ever again. But she just burst out laughing. And she said, "You cheeky sod." She said, "I've been talking to you for weeks and you've never even mentioned it." She said, "I don't care. You sound brilliant anyway. I'd like to see you." So she said, "Tell me where you live. I'm coming to see you." So she jumped in a taxi and came to my flat. I'd not long moved out and I wasn't driving at the time. My car was on order. One thing left, we'd gone on like a house on fire. She was only 17, but bear in mind, I was only 22. But mentally, I was about 14 because my dad died when I was 14, and my mum became like massively overprotective. My mother also had like a lot of mental health issues and she had a breakdown, probably caused the pressure of my dad dying, but also the pressure of having me, but also the pressure of taking on the court case and everything else. Plus, she was very Catholic when I was born, and she had six children. I was number five of six. And she had a girl after me. I've got a younger sister, Liz. So, no wonder she's had a breakdown, with all these kids. Before I left home, I was the last sibling living in the house. Even though my mother had six children, she wasn't really that maternal. And by the time my brothers and sisters got 16, they were either thrown out or they left. My two brothers went away to sea. My older sisters were thrown out because mothers didn't like the boyfriends. And even my younger sister Liz was thrown out when she was 15. Social services had to lie about her age so she could rent a flat. And my mother tried to commit suicide and she was on Valium. And in those days, the doctors would give out Valium like sweets. So she was addicted to Valium. So I was basically left with her. And my mother remarried this bloke called Jim, who I hated because Jim called me dad and everything. And he wasn't at all like my dad. My dad was like a big, strong person, and I felt this person was like weak. I mean, I suppose I was a typical teenager. I resented him. I mean, I gave him a hard time, and I feel kind of bad about it now. But as soon as I left home, she divorced him, and she said, "I only married him for your sake." But anyway, I was determined to leave home because I thought I can't live with my mother for the rest of my life on my own in this big bloody house. So I got this flat. But we'll come to about leaving home later on because that's another story. So anyway, Tina came to visit me in my first flat, and we got on like a house on fire. And then one thing led to another, and she never quite moved in, but I saw her basically day and night. And it was the first kind of sexual relationship. I wasn't a virgin. I'd had sex with two women before, but this was like a real full-on relationship where we go to the pub and then we do it and then, you know, do it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had lots of energy. I was a typical 22-year-old. I wish to God I had that energy now. Do you know what I mean? And then I never thought about, you know, precautions or anything like that, because my mother said on national telly I couldn't have kids. So I believed her. Now, I don't know whether my mother said it to protect me, or she just assumed I couldn't have kids, or the lawyers told her, you know, if you say it's infertile, you get more compensation. Or maybe even the doctors. The doctors wrote us off anyway and said I couldn't do this and that, and I wouldn't live for more than 6 weeks. So maybe the doctors told her I was infertile. Who knows? But basically, she was wrong. And when, you know, Tina came to my flat and said she was pregnant, my first reaction was, who the hell have you been sleeping with? Because I thought she'd been, you know, unfaithful. Anyway, she was like, she burst into tears and she was sobbing. And I felt really, really bad. And she said, I haven't seen anyone. She said, I've just been with you all the time. And it's true, she hadn't like moved in, but she practically had moved in. Do you know what I mean? And I felt really, really bad. But the other thing was, oh shit, what am I going to do now? I had no life experience of living independently because I'd just left home. I wasn't in a well-paid job. I'd blown the 22 grand because it didn't last long, you know, when I had the money. Because when I lived at home with my mother and my stepfather, even though I was working in social services, this is going to sound mad, right? My mother gave me £1 a day pocket money to spend, right? And I was going to work. And she let me live on £1 a day. She wouldn't let me have any money. The reason was she didn't want me to go to the pubs with my colleagues and get drunk. My mother, part of her mental health condition, she was dead against drink. And my stepfather liked to drink. And she assumed he was an alcoholic. And she thought I'd become an alcoholic if I went to pub with my mates. I still went to pub with my mates. But it's ridiculous. So I had no idea of the value of money. I mean, my mother didn't rob me or anything like that. Some fillers of my parents did rob the kids of their money, but she didn't. She kept it in the bank. But if I wanted anything, she'd go to shops for me. So, you know, I was like a Tory MP. I didn't know the value of anything. I still don't know the price of milk now. I still haven't got a clue really about money now. But I knew the value of nothing. And I was living in this rented flat in the Obstetrics Lane. It was a nice little sort of like, it was a nice flat, but it was a housing association. And it was in an area where they put all the, quote, problem families. So there was, like, single mothers, disabled people, people with mental health issues. But it was like a whole mixture of different people, you know, in this, like, one area. I was also quite vulnerable. All the communal gardens, they're backed onto Ford Cemetery, a big cemetery where my dad's buried. So I was broken into 3 times. In fact, the first time I was broken into, I'm a really heavy sleeper. I woke up and there was a torch shining through my bedroom window. And I said, who is it? And he said, it's the police. And my first reaction was, what have I done? And he said, you haven't done nothing, lad. You've been burgled. And one of the neighbours saw someone carrying a video over the fence. Anyway, so the idea of becoming a dad and raising a kid in a tiny little flat, which was really tiny, in a job that, you know, I had a job and it wasn't massively well paid. But mentally, I was like really immature. I was about 14. I hadn't really lived yet. You know, I made up for it later on. Do you know what I mean? And I thought, I don't want to be a dad. You know, being a dad was not, you know, I never even dreamt of it. But I said to her, but I was also racked with massive guilt because I was responsible for the getting her pregnant. So I said to her, listen, I'll support you. Whatever you decide, I'll support you. But deep down, I was shit myself. I did not want to be a dad. But there was still some doubt. I wonder if it is mine. It can't be. I can't have kids. So I went to the doctor and got tested and had to provide the sperm sample and everything. And it turned out I was, you know, very fertile. Mm. You know, my testosterone was at a high level. And I'm not bragging. It was just a fact. The tragic thing was, though, her parents decided for her, and they forced her to have an abortion. Now, one part of me, I have to be honest, was relief, because I didn't want to be a dad. But a big part of me was like full of massive guilt, and felt so sorry for her. And I had her dad on the phone, like ranting and raving down the phone and calling me a rapist and everything. But reflecting on it years later, I honestly don't blame the parents' attitudes. Because if you think about it, she was only 17, not long out of school. We didn't know at that time whether thalidomide could be genetic or not. Even the doctors didn't know. And the thought of like the girlfriend being, you know, going out with, quote, a severely disabled person and all that entails, I can understand the parents' fears. Because I never even met the parents, you know what I mean? So I don't blame them now. Also, thinking about it years later, I don't know whether it was what the girl wanted, to be honest, because we never really discussed it. Obviously, I was devastated the relationship had finished, but we messed up a couple of years later, and she was in a relationship, and so was I. We both moved on, and we still keep in touch, and she's happily married now, but we never, ever discussed that. I think we just said, you know, it's a shame the way it ended, but that was all the whole discussion. But thankfully, she's okay, and she's married and happy. And thankfully, you know, I've moved on, but it was a terrible time. And my mother never ever knew, never ever told her. That, you know, I didn't bother. And I remember, like, when I got another relationship, I went into the local chemist, and I asked for their condoms. And the woman behind the counter said, "Don't be silly." I said, "What do you mean, don't be silly?" I said, "I'd like to buy some condoms, please." And she sort of looked at me, you know, with a smirk and said, "Don't be silly." I said, "What do you mean? Sell me some condoms." And all she kept saying was, "Don't be silly." And in her head, the idea of a disabled person having sex was like anathema. It was like, you know, whoa, that can't happen. So she refused to sell me condoms. So I think I called her a stupid cow or something. And I left the shop. And I went to Boots, and they sold me them, no problem. But even then, you know, the negative attitudes.
This is something I want to explore, because I remember in the 80s going to visit an uncle of mine who had a lot of mental and physical disabilities. The institution we went to visit him in, as a young person, I just was overwhelmed by it negatively. And years later, by the 90s, he'd gone into like care in the community in a home with two other people, disabled people. And it was much, much, much more pleasant and civilized. And the difference between that in the 80s and that in the 90s was universes apart. Now, I'm going to get to the story of Mrs. Skelly, going back to when you were at school, what you're in a moment.
Yeah.
What's your experience of that kind of institutionalization and then what we might call the social model of trying to include people in society?
Well, thankfully, I've never been institutionalized. You know, again, I've got my parents to thank for that. So something that I've never sort of experienced firsthand, really. But there were horrendous, the institutions in the older days. They were Victorian, basically. I've always been very political minded. And if you think about the institutions for disabled people, the first ones were built at the same time as the Industrial Revolution. At the same time as the factories were built, they also built the institutions. And the reason for that was, when the Industrial Revolution came about, I'm speaking very simplistically, but people had to keep up with the speed of the machinery. And if you couldn't keep up with the speed of the machines, then you were deemed as unproductive. So this is why the institutions were built. So it was no accident that they were built at the same time as the big factories. We had the big institutions, and they were often built on dividing lines of our labels. So you'd have your institutions for the blind, the institutions for the deaf. You know, if you were the kids with tuberculosis, you go to an institution where all the kids had TB. It was rigidly divided by that. It was also rigidly divided along gender as well. So boys and girls never mixed, they weren't allowed to mix. And even adults, men and women, never mix in these institutions. They were kept separate. Because the idea of disabled people having sex again was like, you know, whoa, that's horrendous. And it was quite common as well for disabled people to be sterilized. even up until the 1970s, this was quite common. I read horrendous cases of like, a woman might go in for an appendicitis operation and she come out sterile because the doctors have sterilized them, you know. I read about a woman with cerebral palsy went in for a minor operation, and without her consent, she was sterilized. And this was legal right up until the 1970s. So it's quite horrendous, really. I've never really had an experience of institutions, but when I got involved in disability politics and when I worked for social services, I used to have to visit these horrible places. I mean, the philosophy has changed a lot now, and a lot of them have adapted the social model, or they speak the social model language, and they're a lot better. But remember, I'll tell you about when I first left home. We were having a works do party, you know, in work, and it was a Christmas party. My stepdad said, "I'll pick you up at 9 o'clock, son." I said, "9 o'clock, sod off. This party's only just, we'll only be just getting started at 9 o'clock." And he said, "You better be ready or else." And I hated the fact when he called me son. He was more protective than my mother was, but both of them were like overprotective, and he treated me like a child. And I think if my dad had lived, he would have said, "Oh, mother, let him get out, you know, let him get on with it." He would have encouraged me to be more independent. Anyway, I was determined not to go home that night. So by 9 o'clock, I went to my mate's house, and the party carried on in his house. And we all got pissed, and I stayed over. It was the first time I stayed over in anyone's house apart from, you know, an auntie, that, you know, without getting my mother's permission. Anyway, the next day, my stepfather was fuming and he wouldn't speak to me. My mother was freaking out. And I thought, "Oh, fuck this, I've had enough." Even though I was grateful for my mother, you know, bringing me up and stuff and not put me in an institution, I thought, "I'm leaving home." So it was a Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock. I go to the bosses of social services. The actual worst time to leave home. I said, "You better find me somewhere to live because I'm not going back home." And the senior social worker like rubbed his chin. He went, "Oh," he said, "are you sure about this?" I said, "Yeah, I'm absolutely positive." So he rang around different places. He rang the Leonard Cheshire Home, and he rang various institutions, and they were all full, or they couldn't accommodate me that night. So then he said, "The language I'm going to use is like what they used in the early 1980s." He said, "How do you feel about living with the mentally handicapped?" And that was the official term they used. And I knew nothing about, you know, learning difficulties or, you know, mental disability or anything like that. But I was so determined to leave home. I thought, I'll live anywhere. So temporarily, they put me in a place called Brookley Hostel for the Mentally Handicapped. And that's what it was called. But it turned out it was the best thing they could have done, because they put me in the staff courses. They were like an annex to the institution. And it was the staff courses. And I had my own little flat. I had a kitchen, a living room, and there was 2 bedrooms. There was one male care assistant who worked in the institution. It was only a small sort of place, really. It wasn't like a massive place. It was a small unit in Neversent. It's been demolished now, but it was only a small place. There was about 15 residents. There was a male carer, and he was assigned to look after me. And at the time, I couldn't do anything for myself. My mother used to wash and dress me, you know, cook me tea. I couldn't feed myself or anything like that. I mean, I could feed myself, but I didn't do any cooking. I didn't even know how to make a cup of tea. But while I lived there, the staff were encouraging me to be more independent, but also my mates at work and my friends would come round, and like they'd set up a microwave oven for me, and I had like a portable electric grill. And my immediate boss, he was into Italian stuff, because he did a degree in Italian, learning how to cook pasta and things like that. I'd never eaten pasta before, apart from tins of spaghetti at home, because that was foreign food to my mother. So, you know, I got into foreign food like pasta. I mean, my mother was so old-fashioned, you know what I mean? But they were in those days. My first dish was cauliflower provençal, which was basically just cauliflower, tin of tomatoes, and lamb chops. And we
No.
may give it a false, you know, a fake Italian name. And all the residents could smell my cooking, you know, from the flat, and like they were salivating because they were getting horrible foods in the institution. But sometimes I'd have, you know, their meals. I didn't cook all the time, but I never sort of mixed with the other disabled people or the people with learning difficulties, because I was ignorant of that myself. I'd never been taught the social model, and I never mixed with other disabled people, and I'd never come across anyone with like Down syndrome before, not really. or didn't know anyone personally, but they were absolutely wonderful people. And like, I'd come home from work by taxi because I wasn't driving then, and the taxi driver would wheel me in. And before I got to my flat, I'd have to shake hands with loads of them, and they'd say, like, "Here's Kevin, here's Kevin." And I was like a minor celebrity, you know, living on the grounds of this place. There were like different levels, you know, of disability. And some of them were quite perfectly capable of living on their own with support. And that's what happens with some of them, because like the place got closed down a few years later, and some of them found their own accommodation, you know, with support. And that's how it should be, you know, instead of living in an institution. That was like a minor celebrity. And they were allowed to visit me, you know, only if they knocked, they weren't just allowed to walk in. You know, it was great, but it was basically the first time I was independent and living on my own. And I remember that I went to the pub for the first time ever without being chaperoned by my stepdad or my brother-in-law. They used to take me to the pub. And I actually hated going to the pub with them. I'd go to the pub with my brother-in-law. This is before I left home. And I'd nurse a pint in front of me all night. And he'd be like down and pints all night, you know, with his mates.
Yeah.
And I'd just sip it. And I couldn't really drink at all. Do you know why I didn't like drinking? Not because of the taste. I couldn't use the loo. There was no accessible loo.
Oh, of course, you don't want to be going to the loo all the time.
Exactly. And also, when you know you can't go to the loo, it's in your mind. So
yeah,
as soon
yeah.
as you have a sip, all you can think about is, I need to go to the loo. Ooh. So all night I was trying to hold it in, and I'd be in agony by the time I got home and immediately go to the loo. Finally, they kicked me out of Brookley. I couldn't stay there. But luckily, Hornby Housing Association had rang up social services and said, we've got a flat, and the bloke who lived there had no legs and he died. So know of anyone who could live in the flat, it's partly adapted. Services was trying to evict me from Brookley. So they immediately put my name forward to get this flat, you know, in Nunsford Close, off Sterrett Lane. So I was thrilled a bit to get my own flat, the first time ever in my own home. And then I moved in. And I remember the first night I was in the living room. And I was all to the carpet. There was a rolled up carpet that hadn't been fitted. And there was a kettle on a shelf in the kitchen. The kitchen hadn't been adapted. But there was a kettle and a bottle of milk and a microwave. And it literally was thundering and lightning. It was like a dark and stormy night. I was watching telly, which was on like this little box, because there was no furniture or anything. But I was just thrilled to bits. I was in my own home, my own flat. And then in the middle of this thunderstorm and thunder and lightning, there was a tap on the living room window, tap, tap, tap. And I just saw these big staring eyes. And I said, "Who is it?" And there was a voice saying, it's Dave. So I opened the door, and the guy walked in, and he had like a severe limp. He was dragging his right leg, and he had a speech impairment. And he actually had muscular dystrophy. That was his disability, and he lived next door. He said, I saw you move in. I just wanted to say hello. So we got chatting, and he became like a good friend, and he was really helpful. And I think I borrowed some sugar off him because I had no sugar in. And I made him a cup of tea, and then that was the first night at home, in my own home, and it was fabulous. And then, you know, I met Tina, et cetera, et cetera. I got another girlfriend who I was madly obsessed with, and then that finished because her parents didn't like me. I always found that even if the girl wasn't bothered about my disability or we got on brilliantly, the parents were definitely negative.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is kind of, again, partly understandable. Everyone was negative about disability in those days, even more than they are now, and they're still negative now.
No, but I mean, one of the things I'd say, Kev, is like...
Yeah.
The idea of the social model of disabilities, the idea that instead of just giving people medication or putting them in institutions, that you say, we want people to be in society, supported as much as possible, but to have dignity. And that really society needs to move towards the people rather than the people being rejected from society.
Yeah.
And listening to you, I always remember reading the Motorcycle Diaries, Che Guevara going around Latin America.
Yeah.
And on the cover, it just said, at the end of the day, Marxists just want to have fun. And
what
I'm getting from your story is you just want to live a normal life, whatever normal means. And you don't want to be defined by your disability. And I do think we have come a long way with that social model. And I think that you're living proof that people can transcend difficulties. Yeah. You're active. You've worked. You've been involved in disability political campaigns.
Yeah.
You're married with children, etc. And it just goes to show what the right opportunities and the right attitude can give people.
Yeah, 100% correct. Absolutely. But for most of my life, disability wasn't an issue. I know that sounds crazy, but it was something that wasn't really at the forefront of my consciousness. Even when I got involved in politics, I never got involved in disability politics. Mm. I came to disability politics really late. It wasn't until about 1995, the year the Disability Discrimination Act came about. So the reason being that I was brought up as just like a member of the family, you know, with my brothers and sisters. I had non-disabled friends. I went to, for most of my life, mainstream schools, and it just wasn't an issue. But how I came across the social model, though, even like, you know, when I was living independently, I'd go to nightclubs, right? And bouncers would carry me up the stairs, and I'd be ever so grateful for being carried up the stairs. Mm. Now I won't go anywhere where there's stairs. You know, if it's not accessible, they can, you know, fuck them. I'm not going to give them my business. But I used to be grateful for being carried upstairs in nightclubs. What was that one in Litherland? It's not there now. They've demolished it.
Clouds,
yeah. Before that, I went to Clouds. I can imagine the bouncers carrying me up there. It's just nuts. But I used to be grateful because I was like with my mates getting pissed and stuff like that. But it was nuts. It was absolutely crazy. But how it came about the social model, I've always been very political. Like, when I first left home, I joined the Socialist Workers' Party, right? I mean, mother was never a Tory, but she was never, like radical. She was a Daily Mail reader, so, you know, that's sad, isn't it? I threw myself into everything that would, like, piss me mother off. You know, because she protected me so much, I wanted to prove to her that, you know, I wasn't her little boy anymore. So I joined the Socialist Workers' Party. And I used to sell the paper on the corner of by the Black Bull in Walton Vale. Hmm. And it said Socialist Worker, Socialist Paper. And it was fabulous. And I'd go on all the demos. Ironically, I went on an anti-Victoria Gillick march, which she wanted like to bring in severe abortion laws. Hmm. And I went on the march. And I remember the chant, free abortion on demand, it's a woman's right to choose. And this is at the time when, you know, I got someone pregnant and sadly, she had to have an abortion. It was fucking horrible. But I went all the demos going. I went on the anti-apartheid demo, which was the biggest demo before the Iraq War one. Mm. When Thatcher invited the ambassador back from South Africa, and he was there in his big gold carriage and everything, and it was like 100,000 on the march, and it was amazing. Mm. But disability wasn't an issue. I wasn't bothered about disability politics. I'd never come across the social model, and yet I was disabled. Which, you know, you might find that hard to believe. How I came across it was, there's a thalidomide like myself who lives in Southport, Teresa. She's got no arms and legs. And she was involved in, like, disability groups. And I wasn't interested. And she said, come along to a meeting at Liverpool University. It's called Ideas in Motion. I said, oh, yeah, what's that about then? She said, it's about disability rights. I said, I'm not interested. Disabled people, it'll be full of wheelchairs. And she said to me, what the hell do you think you're sitting in a fucking Batmobile? So she persuaded me to go along. And it was the best thing she ever did for me. It was amazing. There was a guy called Lawrence Clark there who's kind of like, he's sort of a semi-famous comedian now. And he has cerebral palsy. Yeah. And he has a speech impairment. And he had to really concentrate because I'm partially deaf. I had to really concentrate on what he was saying. But he was saying things like, you're disabled by society. The fact that you can't go into a building is not your fault, it's the building's fault. And that building is disabling you. If you can get into a building, then you're less disabled than if you can't get into the building. It's the structure of society that is disabling you. If you can't get on a bus, you're more disabled than if you could get on a bus because the bus is accessible. But it's not the fault of the wheelchair user. It's the fault that society is not accommodating the wheelchair user. And it's not just physical barriers. It's also attitudinal barriers. If an employer won't employ you because you're disabled, the problem's with the employer, not with you. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head. Immediately, I got it straight away. Mm-hmm. And immediately, I was like so angry at myself that I never got it beforehand. Yeah. So I stopped being great. I stopped going to nightclubs where I had to get carried in. I stopped giving my custom to businesses that excluded me. But even like a few years before, I went to New York on a holiday. Well, it was kind of like sort of a semi-holiday. And the hotel had laid on a coach, which was accessible, for wheelchair users. I wanted to go to this conference, not around disability. The coach didn't turn up. So I was in a panic thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do now? And a woman in the lobby of the hotel said, oh, gee, honey, just use the regular bus. I said, I can't get on a bus. I'm in a wheelchair. She said, they've all got ramps. They're all accessible. When I found out that the buses were accessible, I was on cloud nine. I spent the whole fortnight in Manhattan getting on and off a bus and traveling on my own all around Manhattan. And it was fucking amazing. It was like the best feeling I've ever had.
Do you know what though? Something as basic as that, it's just a human right where, oh, you haven't got to worry. Like the way you said, like you go to the pub and you're worried about the toilet. Now, Kev, I think we'll speak again, but we've only got a few minutes left now. I just want you to tell me, I'm going to share your blog and any contact details you want to share with people because your story is amazing. But also your stories, it's so normal as well, and I think that's great. Can you just say in a couple of minutes, very briefly, the story of Mrs. Skelly? Because this really touched me when I read it. When you went to school, right, your first experience of school, just tell us very briefly about Mrs. Skelly, because I think that's something that is very powerful.
Well, in the next interview, I'd like to be more political and talk about, the joining the Disabled Action Network and things like that.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
Right. The first school I went into was the Greenbank School of Recovery and Rest, or Rest and Recovery, the Greenbank School of Rest and Recovery. And it was basically an institution by Sefton Park. And it was basically where all disabled kids were dumped. It was a place of containment. It wasn't about education, because in those days it was run by the National Health Service. Education was at the bottom of the list of priorities. I was in a classroom full of different types of impairment groups, and they were also different ages. There was kids from 4.5 to 16 in the same bleeding classroom. Now, how can a teacher teach anything in that situation? So we were basically just playing toys and, doing nothing really. We weren't learning anything. I mean, mother realized I would never get an education there. So she tried to get me into the local schools, and they all said no. In those days, under the law, under the Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Act, a parent of a disabled child had two choices. They were either educated at home or they went to a special school. There was no other option. And in those days, mainstream schools could just say no. They didn't even have to give a reason. So my mother wrote a letter to the Echo. Again, she used the power of the media to say, I wasn't getting an education. She knew I was intelligent, I had a brain. And she knew that this school was the worst thing for me. So there's a forward-thinking journalist, actually, who followed my story and the other thalidomide throughout her career, called Monica O'Hara. I think she was like deputy editor of the Echo. And she wrote a big, long piece about it. And reading the story was a woman called Miss Skelly. It was a headmistress of Dovecot Primary School, near Highton in Dovecot. And she was a really forward-thinking teacher. She was one of the first women to go to Oxford University, and she was amazing. She read the article, and she went to Greenbank, and she decided to take all thalidomides that were there to her school. There was 12 of us. They said to her, you can leave Kevin here, he's one of the worst. And she said, if Kevin doesn't go, none of them go. And when I heard that, I was like massively touched. The reason I found out about it was when she retired to the Isle of Man, and she lived till she was about 92. And she kept saying, my children, my children. She never had any kids. She never even got married. Because in those days, if you were a female head teacher, if you got married, you had to leave the job. Isn't that mad? Isn't that insane? So the only name she could remember for some reason was Kevin. So the neighbours who were looking after her when she died contacted the Thalidomide Trust and said, do you know any Kevins in the Liverpool area? And they obviously put them in touch with me. And the neighbours came over on the ferry with a big archive of like film and photographs. I think I've showed you some of it, haven't I? Of my school days in Dovecot. And it's an amazing, important archive, historically in terms of disability, but also in terms of women's rights as well. What Miss Skelly did, as a woman, it was amazing. So she took all of us to this school. Apparently, before we went there, she read the riot act to the staff and also the parents. Because apparently, some of the parents complained saying, "We don't want all these disabled people in our school. It'll disrupt, my child's education, all that rubbish." So she basically, told them what was happening.
What year was that, Kev? What year did that happen?
Okay, I was in Greenbank from about the age of 4.5 to 7. So
And
it was
then you
about
entered Drucker.
1969, it was April
Right.
1969.
Time's almost up, Kev. That's a very moving
Okay.
story. I just wanted to get that in, and we'll
Yeah.
speak again
Yeah.
if that's all right with you. But I want people to just
Okay.
think about that, how much of a decision that was, and maybe the impact it had on your life. And maybe we could talk about that next time as
Yeah.
well.